of origin for the BE freeze and BE fours that they're building. They're going to put the BE threes in the Antares rocket probably a couple of years down the road. So a lot of things happening. We drop it. Wallops Island is being rebuilt. Probably be ready for the springtime launch. So maybe they'll just have one or two Cygnus cargo crafts go up on the Atlas rocket by Boeing. And after that, Antares, the new Antares rocket that was built by Orbital, actually Orbital Science at the time, now ATK Orbital, do that process. So I just want to bring that up to speed because I know I was asked that. People are probably wondering what the near-term future is after the you've had three problems, one by Orbital back in October, and then the Russians with the Progress, and now this one by SpaceX, and the last two were back-to-back. So, Dick, it was plutonium-239. I know that's what they use on the RTG.
It's good to know. Plutonium-239. This mission that failed today, was that bringing up consumables as well as a international docking adapter? And of course, because of the failure, it sounds to me, if there was a docking adapter being brought up, it sounds to me like that was lost. It sounds like it's a fairly expensive component. And is there a backup that can be sent later? Or am I confused as to what was on this particular mission today? Back to you, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, there's always food and water on these missions, but like the Japanese one, they send theirs up. This is the HGV-5. This will be the fifth one that they send up. They primarily deal with water and food. I mean, very little science stuff. But on this, they had some kind of a scrubber for to keep the water clean on board the station. They've had problems up there, and this expensive unit was also on the Cygnus rocket, Cygnus spacecraft by Orbital. When the Antares blew up, that piece of equipment went with it. And ironically, here's the second try to bring this up. They rebuilt it, and it blew up. And that is the third one that they plan on doing, but that's a year away. So they're gonna be short the scrubber. Got to be a little careful with their water, they said. Outside of that, they're okay for food and stuff. So on board was the IDA, the International Docking Adapter, the first of two. The idea is to have two ports. You'll be able to have two crewed spacecraft attached at the same time on the American side. You can already do that on the Russian side. So on board was some of the spacesuits up there were getting old. They had problems with one. They wanted to bring another one back, bring this one up, and eventually some more. They're getting a little, they've been up there for years, used many times. So now there is a part for a third IDA, they call them IDAs, International Docking Adapters. They'll be putting that together because they still want two. One is lost. The other one was, completed. So all they have to do is, wait for another flight, get that up to the station, and temporarily stow that on the station, and then wait for a full complement crew of six, and then they were going to have Mark Kelly. The astronaut that's staying up there for a year and another American go out and do the work on the ITER. Back to you, Dick.
Earlier you said you need a crew of six astronauts on board in order to install the IDA. That seems like a lot of people. I can't believe they're all outside. I guess a certain number have to be on the inside and a certain number on the outside. And to coordinate that installation. Is that what's going on there, Paul? Go ahead.
Oh, no, they could do it with three, but the three guys, they want to do it with two Americans. Mark is already trained with the other guy. They spent countless hours in the pool doing this. I mean, there's a lot to this, attaching this to the PMA pressure mating adapter. And not only, you know, physically bolting this thing up, but all kinds of connectors, things that have to be done, power sources, data sources, eventually cooling has to be exchanged between the spacecrafts and the dock, and all the stuff has to be done. And the guy that's going to be working with Mark Kelly is there, you know. So he's coming up on the next crew.
When you're bringing up cargo, consumables, cargoes and things like that, and you have failures, and yet similar rockets are used to bring up and bring down human beings, and lucky for us, any of the launchers that bring up human beings seem to be super reliable, and if you're going to get failures, I certainly would much rather have a failure of something that's bringing up materials and not people. What extra steps did we do to make sure that the people launches don't have these failures up all? And is there a way of applying that procedure to the cargo trips? I know that's a vague question, but you see where I'm going on that one. WS2N, T2LIW.
We got the only vehicle so far that have brought, you know, people up, you know, all the shuttles and the Soyuz spacecraft, launched by the Soyuz rocket. So, you know, the shuttles, of course, are retired since 4 years ago, 2011. And the Progress vehicle, that's just a cargo vehicle, and that's also launched by the Soyuz rocket. That's why they were so concerned. That's why this crew that's going up at the end of July, they were supposed to go up. They're supposed to be up there already. But they're on hold. So they decided, you know, what the problem was. Apparently they rushed. They now have an idea of what caused the last Progress craft to blow. Mating system between Progress and the Soyuz spacecraft apparently had a problem. They upgraded it and then they had a problem. So now they've taken a step backwards and they're doing the old system. And they're going to find out. Well, they already had a similar launch for a satellite. That went okay, but this will be the first Progress mission since April. And I'm sure if this goes fine, they'll give them the go-ahead for the Soyuz launch at the end of July, which obviously the only way the Americans we're going to be bringing people up is two ways to the space station, and that's going to be on the Dragon spacecraft, launched by the same Falcon 9 rocket that blew up today, exact same one, and they have to get find a bug that caused that problem. No question about it. But it has been highly reliable. They probably had at least 18 flights, and probably at least 7 or 8 with this upgraded version of the Falcon 9 rocket, and 100% success until today. So that'll be launching people, Falcon 9. And the other one that will be launching people is the Atlas V. Atlas V is built by Boeing and Lockheed. Together, they're called the United Launch Alliance, ULA, and they'll be putting a crewed vehicle on top of the Atlas V within a couple of years, and that vehicle is called the CST-100, under development by Boeing. So you'll have, you know, a proven Atlas rocket. I mean, that thing is Atlas V. Well, they've been around for decades, but the newer version. Atlas, you know, they had an Atlas 1 and Atlas 2, they skipped 3, they had an Atlas 4, and now they have the Atlas 5, and highly successful rockets. You know, they launch all this expensive military stuff and everything, and they just don't have failures. That's what's going to be launching people. The Atlas V and the Falcon 9. Back to you.
I have the impression that one of the other things being brought up today was a water scrubber. What does that do, Paul? Why does the water need scrubbing? Is this potable water for human consumption, or is this the water that they use hydrolysis on in order to get the oxygen out of the water for human consumption? So why does the water need scrubbing? What's being scrubbed out of that water, if you happen to know, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
No, I'm not an expert in that field, but I know they use it for, they use the water for naturally everything. And before they do it, I think it's pressurized into these tanks with these filters, you know, almost like a pressurized osmosis process or something. And basically it looks like a pretty heavy unit. Must be some complexity to it, because they don't have another one like laying around. They're not going to go Home Depot and send one up. Got to rebuild another one of these things. They've lost two. I don't know what's really involved. I don't know if there's electronics involved or what's going on with this thing. That's not my deal, that's for sure. It's hydrology, I guess. Back to you, Dick.
Let's see if anybody's got any further questions for Paul on the subject of space before we go back to broadcast electronics. Anybody got any further questions for Paul? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW, the TechNet. Okay, there being none. Joe, I know you had an additional question you wanted to ask. W2RYY, K2RIW, the TechNet. You got it, Joe.
Too much feedback here. Okay, good evening, Vic, again. First of all, let me tell you about my measuring apparatus before I even ask you about the question here. I noticed a problem with a station, apparently, some sort of station that's near me, a broadcast station, on the AM broadcast band. My car radio is capable of receiving that, a half a microvolt at 60% modulation with an AM, you know, signal applied to it. So I know it can receive down that low. It's not like, you know, you might think 10 microvolts or 5 microvolts, that's true. It's 0.5 microvolts at least. I say very clearly it's 0.5. My service equipment for listening to that frequency is capable of listening to about 2-3 microvolts in that frequency range. Not too much better than that, but that's not really too terribly important. So let me tell you about the station. The station operates the AM broadcast band at 540 kilohertz. And I happen to notice it's actually quite by accident by going by and scanning channels. I'm not listening to that because I have Spanish content programming on the thing, and I don't understand that, but that's neither here nor there. But I happen to catch them as I was maybe about a half a mile from the transmitting antenna site, which is over by 111 and the Southern State Parkway. TOT works good. I have it set to 88 seconds. And, let's see here. I happened to catch them as I was riding by, and I heard them broadcasting a lot louder, apparently on 1080 kilohertz. And later on, I did some more examinations, and I could hear them also on 1620. Now, this station runs 10,000 watts, omnidirectional, daytime. And it has a signal output, according to the FCC information, measured of 1,000 MV per meter at 1 kilometer. So that's a pretty healthy signal. Here's the thing I noticed with them, and this is going to get into part of the question here. I can pick up their second harmonic, whatever the radiating at 2 times their frequency, on 1080 kilohertz from the original frequency of 540, as far as away as about 7 to 8 miles, I can actually hear their program contact before it disappears. More in the direction of north to northwest than east, for some unknown reason. I'm not sure why that's happening. I went near the transmitter site, and using my service instrumentation, service monitor, I got to a point where I was able to receive them with a, you know, magnet antenna at about, I think I used about a 25 or 30 inch antenna rod, as long as what I had. It wasn't a quarter wave, to me, it was much, much longer than that, to be able to get a, you know, fairly good signal. And I got these services to measure them at about minus 40 dBm. So I wasn't going to, I didn't want to close to get too close to overload my instrumentation because, you know, an erroneous reading. Their second harmonic at 1080 kilohertz was about 55 dB down, and it was about 60 dB down at 1620 kilohertz. So here comes the question with all this, the information now. Since an antenna has to be resonant to radiate the signal, remember you keep on saying resonates and radiate, how can this transmitter put out enough energy hearable at a distance of 7 to 8 miles away at two times the frequency when it's, the antenna is not even close to being a resonant on that frequency? And also hearing the 1620 kilohertz energy at about maybe 1 mile away. So how do you explain something like that, Dick? Back to you.
I sure wish, Joe, it was possible for you to use a very high selectivity bandpass filter tuned to 1060 or 1620 to make sure that when you're measuring second harmonic on whichever receiver you're using, that there isn't any overload of your receiver generating the second harmonic. I doubt that. I think they're really radiating the second harmonic. But now, yes, I have said those magic seven words zillions of times. You resonate first, and then you can radiate. In that particular context, the word radiate means radiate from the amateur radio point of view. Let me explain. From the amateur radio point of view, radiate means that if I'm generating 100 watts, I'd like 95 of those watts to be radiated into space. That's my definition of radiation. If I was getting 50% efficiency and only 50 watts is being radiated, I'd sort of tolerate it, but I'd be unhappy with it. Okay? Talk to an electromagnetic compatibility engineer. His definition of radiation is that there's a leakage signal there that shouldn't be there, that's 55 or 60 dB suppressed. That's his definition of radiation. Okay. The power supply wiring, your leakage from a connector, the re-radiation from the signal that feeds through the brain. There's a zillion ways you can get radiation 55 and 60 dB down. So although an EMC engineer will call that radiation, no ham radio operator will call minus 60 dB. Minus 60 dB means that the undesired signal 60 dB down is 1 millionth of the power of the main signal. So, resonate, and you can radiate from a ham radio point of view. A non-resonant antenna, can it radiate an undesired signal 55 dB down? Easily, even though it's non-resonant. And now, non-resonant is a relative word, okay? On the 1080 frequency, let me drop it. Let's assume that the antenna being fed at the bottom at the desired frequency of 540 kilohertz, the antenna is a 37 ohm impedance, and the second harmonic of that antenna, maybe not a 37 ohm, but 3,700 ohms. You know, something really weird. Highly capacitive, highly inductive, high impedance. And can something of that much impedance mismatch radiate a signal 55 or 60 dB down? Absolutely. If the signal is really there, in other words, if the transmitter, for whatever reason, because of the way the final stage is biased, or you're sort of asking the question now, what's the mechanism by which the transmitter can generate second and third harmonic? That's fairly easy to do. And what kind of filtering is used? So even though the antenna is not intended to resonate at that second or third harmonic, 55 or 60 dB down, that strikes me within the realm of possibility for that kind of very inefficient radiation. 50 dB down would be 100,000-to-1 ratio. 60 dB down is a million-to-1 ratio. So even with a huge impedance mismatch, you can do that. So I think with your further testing, let me drop it. I think you're going to find that the second harmonic and third harmonic is real, and they're really doing it. And we'll have to ask Eric about this. I thought the FCC requirements for undesired products should be suppressed by 60 dB. And if you're measuring 55, that sounds like a potential failure. But before we condemn them, it sure would be nice to use some kind of a filter. It could be a simple filter, just a coaxial stub that gives you a notch at 540. If you could notch out to 540 to make sure that none of your equipment is being overloaded, and then you go and re-measure the 1080, that would be a beautiful confirmation, Joe. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Okay, well, before you can, it sounds like you're going in a direction like you're blaming the equipment as possibly measuring the thing falsely. I've already taken a service monitor with two other generators, the HP generator I have and another one at another time, and I measured it. As long as I don't have the initial signal going in much more than about minus 40 dBm into the antenna jack, it'll pretty much see something else elsewhere in the band and be able to tune to it and display it fairly accurately without giving you, like, images. This service monitor has a 4 conversion receiver in it, so it's very, very good as far as keeping outside product that don't belong there. It's not like some of the Motorola products that they made with service monitors that had, like, you know, single conversion receiving or, you know, two conversion receiving or something like that. They could see stuff all over the place. This thing is not really like that. Very, very good. But that's why I also depended on my car radio, because car radio, hearing something at 7 to 8 miles away, I'm no longer being overloaded by the fundamental frequency. I mean, it's strong, but I don't get a problem with other stations. Problem is, no other stations can measure with the car radio because there's nothing low in the band. Locally around here, I could drive to the only other stations that's like 1370 to do a comparison, but I couldn't receive it. But I couldn't receive the second harmonic, so that would be kind of useless. But I could do the same with my service monitor and see if I get the same effect with them. And if I don't, would you think that kind of proves that the first station is actually radiating stuff that they don't belong?
The WHRYY that I know, making these kind of measurements, I give you a 95% probability that the second harmonic you've measured is real. I'm recommending, though, Joe, just to be double darn sure if you could. It'd be nice to notch out the 540, just to be double darn sure. And your process of notching that out is going to create an extra, let me pick a number, 2 or 3 dB of insertion loss on the 1080 frequency, and maybe the 1620. 1620, is that the right number? I think it is. 1620, the third harmonic. I believe that they're real, but just to be double darn sure, sure would be nice to notch out the fundamental, in which case you can have more faith, you can move closer, and so on. Even though the antenna is not tuned to that frequency, 55 dB down, that's easy. The amount of filtering required at broadcast power levels to remove harmonics, it's got to be pretty healthy filtering. Not easy at the power levels we're talking about here. So, and for you to make a stub tuner to notch out the 540, I said stub tuner, there's a zillion ways you can make a tuned network that notches only 540. It sure would be nice to notch that out, in which case you can now move a lot closer without getting overload. The fact that your service monitor has third, fourth, or fifth conversions, that's very good when it comes to selectivity. It's very good when it comes to images. It's not good when it comes to second harmonica. I can have a six conversion receiver. If the first few stages of RF amplification up to the very first mixer is even slightly overloaded, it's going to generate a second harmonic that no amount of converting downrange is going to eliminate it. If you're generating the second harmonic, in your RF amplification stages up to that first mixer. Nothing in the world downrange is going to eliminate that. That second harmonic is real as far as that mixer is concerned. So it sure would be nice just to be double down sure to notch the 540. And that could be done with an LC network. It could be done with stub tuners. There's lots of ways you can notch 540 and have very little extra insertion loss on the second and third harmonic of that shell. W2RYY, K2RIW. And by the way, it sure would be nice to check with the FCC standards. I believe undesired products out of a broadcast transmitter are supposed to be suppressed by 60 dB. Over to you, Joe. K2RIW.
Okay, well, can you generate a PDF file? And if so, draw me a schematic of something simple I can make.
I don't promise that right away, but I'll give it some thought. But to notch out a frequency, or admit to do it with coax cable at that lower frequency, it's going to require a lot of cable, so to speak. An LC network. An inductor and a capacitor in series with each other that have high enough Q, and you put it directly from center conductor to ground of the coax cable coming in. That simple network can easily notch you 25, maybe 30 dB. Over to you, Joe. K2RIW.
Okay. Well, I guess I have to do it that way, do it the harder way. But okay. This is actually just a curiosity type of thing. But as I said, as I initially stumbled upon this thing doing this, initially I just ignored it and said, well, maybe I'm just close to the transmitter. But one day I happened to be going up the parkway, going up, all after the expressway, and I can hear it at the SIG and the expressway, just about. And I said, that's pretty far away to hear this, the second harmonic of 2,000 frequency that far away. Because they interfere, actually interfere with WTIC, which is on the same frequency from Hartford, Connecticut. So I figured, it's not really my service instrument that's reading a full thing. I'm hearing on my car radio, too. So that's where this all came from, sort of, just a curiosity. And when I actually had a little more time, I went closer to it and actually measured with the service instrument of what they're actually putting out, what I actually saw on the air.
Yeah, when I want to listen to my favorite NPR station, when I'm on the expressway going out to exit 62, and as I pass by, I think it's around exit 53 or 54, there's an AM broadcast station there. And when I'm within 1.5 miles east or west of that location, it's on, what's the name of that now? Crooked Hill Road. There's an AM broadcast station on Crooked Hill Road, just south of the expressway by 0.5 mile. And so when I'm on the expressway, 1.5 miles east or west of that point, I can no longer hear NPR on my car radio. I'm listening to them on FM, and my radio just goes bonkers. So car radios, from my point of view, are relatively easy to overload. Mine does, on my Toyota automobile. So, before we condemn them, it'd be nice to do a double down sure suppression of the fundamental to be sure the second harmonic is really there. Over to you, Joe. K2RIW.
K2J.
As far as I know, there is no AM station by the expressway in the SAG. Off of that tower, which has cell equipment on the tower, that's 94.3. Not AM, it's FM.
Yeah, I said it wrong. I knew that was an FM station. Eric, when it comes to AM broadcast stations, what's your guess? Is the FCC requiring 60 dB of suppression? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RIW, K2EJ. Generally, everything's between -55 and -60. 60 is the magic number, and that's 60 below carrier. One thing I will say is when you do proof of performance, you do the required FCC measurement. The receiver that you use, except for the Nixon analyzer, requires a blocking filter. So that way the front end of your measuring device only sees the frequency you're interested in. and that way you don't get, you know, the IP3 effects, the mixer overload, the various other things. You try to minimize that in terms of when you're making your measurements. K2RIWK, Georgia.
So I think you're almost saying what I'm saying, Eric. That is, when you're trying to measure a very specific second harmonic and third harmonic, don't do something to actively suppress the fundamental, then no matter how well calibrated your instrumentation is, there'll always be a little bit of doubt as to whether or not you're generating it locally in your own receiver. However, there's one other thing you can do, and that is, back in my spectrum analyzer days, when you're trying to figure out, is that intermodulation distortion you're seeing created by the analyzer that's trying to measure it, or is it really present in the instrumentation you're measuring, in the circuit that you're measuring? If you plug in an extra 10 decibels of attenuation in the front end of the spectrum analyzer, the intermodulation products will move down by 30 dB, the fundamental products will move down by 10. When it comes to...
It still requires you to use a filter on the fundamental all the time.
I understand, but if Joe can put in a 10 dB attenuator, and if the second harmonic that he measures moves down by exactly 10 dB, most likely it's real. If he plugs in a 10 dB attenuator, and the second harmonic he's measuring moves down by anything more than 10, 15 or 20 dB, then quite possibly it's coming from his own instrumentation. So, do you have enough threshold, Eric? Joe, do you have enough threshold that you can plug in a known good broadband 10 dB or 5 dB attenuator and see exactly how many dB suppression you get on both the fundamental and the second harmonic? If they both move down by the exact number of dB you install in the front end of that instrumentation, then that's a pretty strong piece of evidence what you're measuring is real. W2LYY,
K2LIW, the TechNet. Well, as you might have guessed, of course I have attenuators, of course. First of all, the front panel switch on the service monitor lets you go 0 dB, 20 dB, or 40 dB directly by resistance being additive on the antenna input. So, you know, but if I go to 20, yeah, I knock the fundamental down, but I can't see the second harmonic goes below the noise floor of the analyzer, you know, and the receiver. The receiver, remember, the receivers, these things only go down about 2-3 microvolts, or anything below that, they really can't hear. But yes, I have a small, I have attenuated 50 ohm attenuated like 3 dB, 6 dB, and combinations of such, where I can put, you know, some attenuation in there, like a 3 dB to start with, and see, and like you said, the fundamental and the second harmonic go down to about the same ratio. I understand what you're talking about. You attenuate it, and if you see the thing drastically change as far as what the second is, it's probably produced internally in the instrument. If it doesn't, it's probably on the outside, and it's for real.
You've got it. Whenever I overload the front end of a receiver so that I'm looking at intermodulation distortion or second harmonic or third harmonic that's being generated in my receiver, then the laws of physics about the way harmonics are locally generated in the receiver work. They will not move by a linear number of dB. Undesired products of a receiver will move faster than the fundamental when you plug in pure broadband resistive attenuation. So you're using the mechanism of generation of the second harmonic in the receiver to your advantage, recognizing the fact that it has a different slope of amplitude in versus amplitude of response, if you know what I mean. So the combination of nulling out the fundamental and or using attenuation, you're going to be able to do a pretty good job of confirming. Quite possibly the spec is 55, in which case they're right at the spec. But I think it's a high probability you're going to find out it's real, Joe. And so what you do with that information, I don't know. Well, in your case, it's giving you some grief because you can't hear the Connecticut station you want to hear. The B2RYY, interesting stuff. K2RIW, the TechNet.
Well, no. You got the whole thing wrong there. I'm not trying to listen to the station in Connecticut. It's a talk radio anyway up there. That that was the intent. The intent is just purely, you know, scientific curiosity. Okay, that's really where all this comes from, because I just have, as I said, drive within about a half mile of their antennas that go by their on the parkway, and have me hear the same program content. But here's the interesting thing I mentioned with the service monitor. Now, I don't know if you know much about the IFR-1500. It can do a lot of things, you know, when it just doesn't do one thing, it can do many things. I can look at the program content on the second harmonic and third harmonic, and I see 120 cycle energy impressed along with the music or program content of the station, and I do not see that on the fundamental frequency. So what would that lead you to believe?
120 hertz sure sounds like a full-wave rectifier. However, a broadcast station running that kind of power should be using three-phase full-wave rectification, in which you're going to be getting either 6 or 12 pulses from the 60 cycles for each. So 120 hertz, that's not easy to explain. Let's see what Eric's got to say about that. KE2EJ, KE2LAW.
Sorry, I wasn't listening.
When Joe listens to the second harmonic, it has a 120 hertz hum superimposed on the second harmonic. He does not hear that hum on the fundamental. Got a guess as to what's going on? I'm guessing that 120 hertz is what you would hear if it was a one-phase full-wave rectifier. But the kind of power level they're running, I'm almost positive they're running on three-phase full-wave rectification. They wouldn't do one phase of that kind of power. That's my guess. KE2EJ, KE2LAW.
Let me ask two questions. How much power is the station, isn't it? And is it running HD radio at the same time?
You got it, Joe.
No, there's no HD radio. There's no HD content. I know what to look for on that. They're not doing that. Number two, they're running 10,000 watts, 10,000 watts omnidirectional, and the ratings of the FCC site said was something like 1,000 millivolts per meter at 1 kilometer. But this is also a nighttime station, so it goes down to 0.22 kilowatts or 220 watts. Now, I went by there long after sunset one day, a couple of days ago, and the program content still has the same AC hum in it, except the intensity drops dramatically. So it's still up there. I still hear it. I still hear the same effect, but I'm running low power as well as full power. Back to you.
A6DP says with a comment.
Yeah, Eric first, and then Hal in that order. Go ahead, Eric.
All right. Two more questions. Do you know whether it's a solid-state transmitter or a tube transmitter? And do you know if it's a directional station? If it's a nighttime only, I suspect it's directional. Yep. Give me an answer, and then give it to Hal.
Nighttime, they go directional. I can't tell you about what the pattern information is. I don't really understand what I'm looking at on the site. There's a bunch of information on which I didn't write down to be able to repeat it. And number two, I wouldn't have a clue if they're running a solid-state transmitter or tube transmitter. I have no idea what kind of equipment they're actually running.
All right, well, let's give it to Hal. You tell me what station it is. I'll look it up and I'll find out what it is, because there's a couple things that could be happening.
It's 540 kilohertz.
540 kilohertz, WLIE.
All right, can I get it?
Get out.
Yeah, did you check? I work on 1500s. You may have a hum generated in the VCO of the 1500 that's mixing, and it's not really coming from the station. Trust me, all sorts of headaches with 1500s and the VCOs, and, you know, voltage regulation on the oscillators. Maybe your instrumentation, not the station.
But Hal, he doesn't hear the hum on fundamental, but he does hear it on second harmonic. Could his 1500 decide to make a hum on one frequency but not on another? Back to you, Hal.
He's using a synthesizer in it. It may be switching in other things in the synthesizer, because he's working on a second harmonic, not the fundamental. So I would look, first of all, put a carrier in on the frequency second harmonic pure carrier, and 1500 is 120 hertz running on it. That would be my first check. I know the 1500. I work on many of them.
You got it, Joe.
I don't believe the instrument's at fault because I believe I can also hear the same type. If I turn the bass up on my car radio, I believe I can hear the same type of thing coming over the second harmonic and third harmonic frequency. So that would kind of rule out the test equipment.
Kind of, but you're not sure. I would say double check the instrument and then work from there.
But when he tunes his 1500 to 540 kilohertz and then tunes it to 1000 and 80 kilohertz second harmonic, the mechanism by which that 1500 is operating is so close to the same, I'm having trouble believing that the synthesizer gives you grief at that slightly different frequency. Over to you, Hal.
Not running a synthesizer down in those ranges. That's why I would just double check and see what you're getting on the instrument itself. Pull that out to begin with.
Okay. So we're giving Joe some extra homework here. I'm reasonably sure he's going to confirm, though, that what he's measuring could be real. But to be double darn sure, with the nulling of the fundamental and checking on the hum, I remember seeing harmonics coming out of equipment, and the harmonics sometimes have some crazy modulations fundamental doesn't have. The second harmonic is being generated by a kind of nonlinearity in at least one of the stages. And once you've got a nonlinearity, all kinds of funny other effects can happen. So I'm guessing you're going to find out it's real, Joe. W2RYY, K2RAW.
Okay, to satisfy you and the other guy out there, DPZ, I'll take my service monitor. Well, I did this with the car running thing off DC, but I know it has internally power supplies anyway. Those things have a fairly high IF. The first IF is fairly high because I remember looking at the servicing manual for the thing. It's running up to like as high as, to hear like 1,000, it's running, and the LO runs to like 2.2 gig or something like that. So the first IF is pretty high in those things. But anyway, I don't think that's a problem as far as trying to receive something at 0.54 megahertz or 1.080 megahertz, it's going to be different. But anyway, I'll take my HP generator and generator carrier and then generator carrier with modulation and see if it hears anything at 540 or 1080 kilohertz, just to be absolutely sure.
Get JTV to come.
Yeah, Joe, we're going to get you in a second. Many of these receivers, when they're doing reception way down at 1 megahertz, or half a megahertz, that first mixing stage is an up conversion. That's what Joe is describing to us. So when you're up converting to, say, a first IF of around 2.05 gigahertz, whether you're listening to 540, 1000, half a meg, 1 meg, 2 megs, 3 megs, as far as that up conversion is concerned, that's almost the exact same frequency. WJ2B, K2RW, go ahead, Joe.
Okay, guys, WJ2B, I've been listening for a little while to this conversation, and assuming that the instrumentation that Joe is using to measure that second harmonic is not being overloaded and everything is all good with the instrumentation, at those frequencies, it's very possible that there could be something in the vicinity of the transmitting antenna that's actually receiving the signal, rectifying it, and retransmitting the harmonic. It could be a loose connection on an electric wire near that vicinity of that transmitting antenna. But like Eric said, as far as the transmitter itself, it has to be better than 55 to 60 dB down as far as the filtering on the transmitter. But at those frequencies, something could definitely be rectifying that fundamental and rebroadcasting it, possibly a power line, that's what I would think. But I don't have that much experience with AM. I've never heard of that happening as far as, my experience. But maybe Eric might know, but I don't think we got any AM broadcast engineers on the frequency that can tell us right now. But anyway, that's just my speculation at WJ2B.
They are located, their transmitter is located next to another tower, a newer tower, that went up about maybe 10 years ago or so, give or take, 10, 15 years ago. And they're about maybe, 150 meters from the other tower, maybe a little closer than
than that. The other tower is a metallic structure tower that goes up to about, I don't know, 250 feet, maybe a little, maybe 300 feet or something like that. So it's taller than the broadcast antenna.
Joe, when you're measuring that second harmonic, do you see any different directionality of that signal? If you drive a circle around the broadcast station, the fundamental probably is damn close to omnidirectional in the daytime. And when you listen to that second harmonic, does it seem to have any directional characteristics? Over to you, Joe.
Well, the problem is I have to use a car radio for a receiving apparatus because as I drive further away with the antenna I have to receive the broadcast frequency to go into the service monitor, it's only like about a 30-inch whip on a mag mount that's bigger than a quarter wave on 2 meters. So that's all I have really for receiving area. As I drive away, the signal will start going around to minus 50, minus 60 pretty quickly. So I really can't see the second harmonic at that point because it's way below the noise floor of the receiver and the analyzer, so I have to make these measurements kind of close. But one thing I did notice is with the car radio as a receiving apparatus, I don't notice it anywhere near as far as going east as I do going west to northwest. There's a considerable difference in signal strength.
The FCC website during the day with the 10,000 watts, they're highly directional. I'm not sure which directional.
I think the directional at night. I don't think it's 10,000 omni daytime and 0.22 kilowatts directional at night. I read the same thing too, but I don't understand all the information. I don't know exactly what they're talking about.
The more omni at night with the 220, I was looking at the plots. They're highly directional at day with the 10 kilowatts, but they're very, very strong all around this area. So it's very possible they're getting some rectification. If you have any data that you can, that you can prove your instrumentation's good, I would call the station, relay it to the station manager, and he'll relay it to the operating engineer of the station, and he'll investigate it.
But I want to make sure that what I'm seeing is absolutely correct and not something that's false. I mean, the instrumentation is displaying in front of me. So I'll do what K2RIW suggested. I'll put some attenuation in the front end of my receiving apparatus to make sure, absolutely sure, that it's not generating the other information I see. Then I'll come back next week and let you know.
Hey, that's exciting stuff. You guys have just listened to TechNet number 1562 of the series. And you heard Space Report number 155 of the series. 73-year-old. Bye-bye for now. We'll be back next week. Be kind to each other. Over to John for any closing comments. KC2WTV, K2RIW. And go easy with those guys in Staten Island. And by the way, did you get a chance to visit any of the Peel Bay sites in your neighborhood? Back to you, John.
KC2WTV. No, Dick, I didn't get a chance. I had my granddaughter's 16th birthday, which is a big deal. I had to take care of that this weekend. But I'd like to thank everybody for joining the net, and we will see you again next week if everything goes well. Love the mail. Keep it coming. Dick, by the way, did you get that package I sent out?
I sure did. And it runs on 110 volts, right? I take that 9-volt battery socket, put 110 volts in there, and that's going to light it up. John, go ahead.
Absolutely. First, you have to put it under water, though.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I haven't turned it on yet. I'm a little behind in things. And so it didn't come with an instruction manual, John.
Oh, it's easy. You look at that zero force connector, 1, 2, 3, are what you're going to be using. A resistor, like across terminal 1 and 3, it'll read it as a resistor or a capacitor. Or you can plug in a 3-lead device like a CMOS or a transistor. Oh, yeah, 9-volt battery. You'll have a lot of fun with that. And then when you work on it, I have to send you one more little item I want you to look at and test on there and tell me why it happened. Every time I get something, I always find something weird. It's just my nature.
Is that printed circuit board of your design, John?
No, this is something that was sent to me for evaluation. It's going to be included in a, I think I told you, like a Pelican case. It's going to be like maybe 20 of them in there or 30 of them in a Pelican case with a big Amphenol connector to plug into a panel of parts that's doing a specific job. And they will kill this panel and then just plug in this device and should be able to test everything.
give me the mic. JD2 CBV.
Hey, good evening, Todd. If we get interrupted, we'll go to 147.
Even. Okay, I was waiting for the other. Okay. I'm gone. JD2 CBV.
You're going there now?
2 PPM.
Where were you guys on Friday keeping me company on my long trip home?
I don't know. What time were you heading home on Friday?
I left the city at 5:30. I didn't hear either you or Stevie at all. You guys said you'd come on to keep me company.
Oh, 5:30. Where was I 5:30? I don't even know what I was doing at 5:30. I was probably already in the zone. I don't know about Stevie, though.
So what did you mix up this past Friday?
Let's see. Probably not much of anything. Cut 'em Loose Bruce came over and, working on his Yukon for him.
Okay. So, how was the weekend for you? Nice and moist?
Oh, yeah. Moistness was, everywhere to be found.
Yeah, at least I didn't work. I got out of town. It was moist up in Monticello, but I wasn't anywhere near work.
Monticello moistness. Well, Saturday morning I got out and about. I did speak to Stevie Saturday morning. I was hoping to get the motorcycle inspected on Saturday, and I did manage to get over, get it done. But on my way back, I was going to be running some other errands, and on my way back, I started to run into a little bit of a spritz. I bike back in the garage and took the car and ran the rest of the errands with that, and then I managed to squeak in doing the rear brakes on the Toxic Avenger, but the moistness got too much to be dealt with.
So front brakes on the and rear brakes on the Toxic Avenger. Between the two, you have a full set of brakes.
No. All the brakes were done on the Toxic Avenger.
Okay, so you got a car and a half of new brakes.
No. I did the fronts on, I think it was Wednesday. Yeah, I think I did the fronts on Wednesday or Thursday, and then Thursday, then Cut 'em Loose Bruce came by on Friday, but I still had the noise, that wonderful noise that sounded like a subway train pulling into the station, and so I said, you know what, I'll just do the rears. So I ordered up all the stuff to do the rears, and I banged those out on Saturday morning. So now the Toxic Avenger has new rotors, new pads, all rocking and rolling, ready to go. And to keep me in.
And to ZDP. And so,
yeah, the noise was coming from the right rear. Once I pulled the wheel and saw what was going on, I said, okay, that explains it.
One did score rotor, warped rotor. What was the situation?
Worn pads.
So the four rotors that you pulled off, can they be refaced and reused, or are they in the scrap heap?
Recycle. They went into the recycle bin. Nobody refaces anymore. It seems to be a lost art. You don't even bother bringing rotors to get refaced. You just turn around and you buy new ones. So that seems to be the way of the world now. Everything is disposable.